Let's talk.
John Brown. Groundhog Day. A mother's struggle to protect her son from repeated failures of a mental health service. This is the story of a 27-year battle to get the appropriate support for her son and protect him from negligent and at times abusive services. Delighted to say that the author of Groundhog Day, Leslie Brown, joins me live on the line now. Leslie, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Whereabouts, so just explain a little bit, if you can, what the starting point for your book was.
You mean when did I start writing it?
What was the what inspired you? Why was the reason you decided, or the set of circumstances that you decided to write this book?
Because I was really shocked at how awful the services were, and want to improve them. So the whole intention is to shine a light on what happened, and hopefully people will read it who work in services and reflect on their practice.
So explain a little bit about your particular situation, because this is about your son, isn't it, and this long running. So just explain to me sort of the genesis, if you like, of the story. What, you know, how he was, what happened, what was the particular situation?
He smoked cannabis in his late teens and had a very bad reaction to it, and became paranoid. And unfortunately, the GP started him straight away on antipsychotics, which made him worse. And at the time, I just trusted that it was about finding the right medication. And after a while, I realised that the medications were, in fact, harming him.
So, I mean, when did you first sort of realise, was it just, you know, if, as far as you know, he was a normal teenager? Can we mention the name of your son? Is that okay? I'm not sure if
no.
you...
No.
Okay.
No, I've called him William
in
the book.
Okay, super.
I really want to protect his privacy. No, he was a difficult teenager. There were problems. But I think also he was very, very sensitive. So whereas lots of his peers were smoking cannabis and were fine, He actually became quite paranoid. And at the time, I had just completed a psychiatric placement because I was training to be a psychotherapist. So I got advice from the psychiatrist who I had done my placement with, who was actually excellent. She was a really good psychiatrist. She set the bar very high, and that was my expectation of services. So she advised that I would go to the GP without him, explain the situation, and she recommended a psychiatrist who dealt with double diagnosis. So not just a psychosis, but also psychosis resulting from using drugs. So I did that. I went to the GP. He apparently listened, told me to come back with my son. And when I went back with him, he didn't refer him. He just put him straight away on an antipsychotic. And William had a really bad reaction. His side of his face went paralysed. It was awful. I took him back. He gave him a different antipsychotic, and he just plummeted. He just withdrew. So I then telephoned a cousin who's a doctor, who phoned the GP and insisted that he referred him. And that was the start. So he was then referred into services. But by this time, the picture had changed, because he'd been given antipsychotics which had affected him, so he was then treated with other antipsychotics. It was just a downward spiral until eventually he was admitted to hospital.
So presumably, I mean, he's had this reaction, he's become paranoid, he then is given prescription drugs, and that increases the paranoia. I mean, one might have thought that he would have been seen at that point by specialists, referred to, you know, to some sort of clinical thing, rather than just, oh, for goodness sake, you know, give him a pill and please go away.
Exactly.
I look back,
there are several points in the story that I've called sliding door points, where if things had been different, if you'd have had different treatment, the whole outcome could have been very, very different.
So
there's another issue, if people aren't really monitored when they're on these drugs.
So what is your reaction then when, you know, he becomes even more withdrawn, he becomes even more paranoid? I mean, presumably he's living with you at this stage. How does that manifest itself? I mean, how do you live with, you know, somebody, you know, your son, who suddenly isn't your son because he's on this cocktail of the drugs which are sparking and increasing his paranoia and presumably other sort of behaviours?
Actually, they didn't increase his paranoia. The paranoia stopped, but he just became very, very withdrawn. I'm very depressed. I'm very volatile. I'm just trying to think what happened. I mean, there was a really awful incident when he threw a television at his brother. And at that stage, I called the police. He was then seen by a psychiatrist who said he wasn't. It wasn't appropriate for him to be admitted. He wasn't sectionable at that stage, which is really bizarre because later on, once he'd had a diagnosis, they would section him at the drop of a hat. You would just get angry and they'd section him. So it's slightly hazy now, to be honest. It is in the book. But he then, I think we took him to outpatients. He eventually got an outpatient appointment. And for about a year, he just withdrew. And then he would stop taking the medication. And at that stage, the theory was that if people stopped taking the medication, then the underlying illness, they relapsed into an underlying illness. I mean, the theory now is that actually people get withdrawal symptoms from stopping medication. So when he stopped taking it, because he couldn't function, basically, he was wanting to sleep all day. It was just very, very sedated. When he stopped taking it, then he did become psychotic. Mm. And at that stage, he was admitted to hospital.
Anybody who's sort of got any knowledge of the effects that prescription drugs can have, if you put somebody on heavy medication and then take them off it, it is extremely dangerous to not do it straight away. And especially with that medication, I'm thinking that, I mean, we talk about withdrawals, and I'm in no way I'm saying that your son is in the old in these drugs, but if you have somebody who is on heroin, he's then put onto some methadone or whatever to bring them off, to, if you like, as the parlance goes, take the edge off. Rather than just going bam, because that sort of, if you take somebody off a heavy dosage of drugs immediately, that can have an incredibly damaging physical and psychological effect.
Yes, exactly, Giles. That's exactly what happened. And at that stage, because I believed what the psychiatrists and the doctors were saying, at that stage, I thought when he stopped taking his medication, then this underlying illness reoccurred. What eventually happened when he would stop taking medication for a while, he would start to improve. I began to realise that actually it was the withdrawal from the medication that was causing the symptoms. But the other awful thing that's happened is, I think he's actually now sustained a level of brain damage from the medication. So he was very bright. He was at top streams of a grammar school. If you met him now, you'd think he had a learning disability. And in fact, friends who do meet him now think he has got a learning disability because he's now in his late 40s. He's not very articulate. He doesn't behave like a man of his age, and he's certainly very different from his brother, which is tragic.
What, I mean, did you have sort of, did you get the feeling that he was just being treated because... We are bombarded with stories about how medical services, psychiatric services, there are more, and some of it can be quite dismissive in the media about, oh, well, you know, the youth, et cetera, Gen Z, they've all got a medical complaint. They're all, you know, they've all got ADHD. They've all got this, that, and the other. They're getting triggered by everything. And there is, some might say, well, the medical services are now being overwhelmed, especially in psychiatric services, because everybody seems to have something with them, a trauma that needs treating. And so, therefore, William didn't get the attention that he needed because of the workload that these people are under? Or do you think it was just a case of these people did not look closely enough, and it's far too easier, rather than trying to do a proper diagnosis, and just say, here, there's a pill, go away?
Yeah, it's that. It's the latter. It actually predates all the sort of hype around things like ADHD.
Right.
I think it's because a large proportion of the psychiatric service believe in the biomedical model and think that it's an underlying illness that's cured by medication. There is now an increasing number of psychiatrists who challenge that. And the tragedy was that all they were interested in was giving him drugs. They looked at me like I came from another planet when I suggested that he needed support, he needed emotional support, he needed a daytime occupation that to make him feel valued. Because I'd also worked in learning disability services, so I saw a massive difference between learning disabilities 30 years ago when I was working in them and psychiatric services. I was shocked with the standard, with the lack of care, with the lack of a holistic model. It's been appalling. It is changing. There is now the beginnings of a paradigm shift towards looking at what's causing people's distress rather than putting it down to some underlying biological illness for which there are absolutely no biological markers. And also there are groups of mental health professions who are trying to do things differently. So I have worked with our local trust on various projects to improve services. Unfortunately, it's a massive, big, bureaucratic service. And one part of the service changes, another part doesn't. So what's been tragic for me is I was working with one part of the service who were really wanting to do things differently, and my son was being seen by another part of the service who hadn't caught up. So it's been a nightmare, honestly.
I just think, I mean, I members of my family have got learning difficulties, and that they have been involved in there are various charity groups or government groups which get them, you know, doing things, you know, so they have day centres, they are working in, you know, garden centres, and I mean that they are, you know, supervising that sort of thing, but it shows an incredible, it gets the brain activated. They have some self-worth. If you just give people with issues, stick them in a room and go, there's a pill, and basically sedate them so they don't know what day it is, of course there are going to be huge impacts. I mean, it's not rocket science, is it, Leslie?
No, Giles is spot on. I mean, so there was a period that I've described in the book when I got direct payments and I employed 3 personal assistants and I created my own care plan based on what I'd done with people learning disabilities. He went gardening a few days a week. We had somebody else who took him to the gym. That was a really good period and he started to improve. That fund, for various reasons, which I've described in the book, that funding was pulled. But not only that, some of the hospital admission were really abusive. So one particular admission when he was put in seclusion was just horrendous. So he was completely traumatized, and so was I, seeing him in that situation. I had to go and talk to him behind a glass wall on a telephone with a bare mattress on the floor. I mean, it's no wonder now he is very anxious and very disabled.
See, the thing is, I'm trying to get my head around why, how people who go into this, do you think this is a staffing issue in terms of, if you've got, you know, people in a hospital and obviously you have a very fragile individual here, and yet people just go, yeah, put him there. It's like it's almost the ultimate job's worth, isn't it? Okay, can we just deal with it? I'm so hassled. We'll just put your son behind that glass, the glass thing. You'll just, you know, because I've got so many cases to deal with. And medicine should not be like that.
It's split, though. I have to say there are also some good people who are passionate about making changes. But also there are people who are drawn into working with vulnerable people because they themselves have difficulties relating and they feel better than. I mean, I saw that in learning disability services as well. There was a complete split between those of us who are passionate about giving people a more valued lifestyle and people who are basically abusive. And it's the same thing in mental health services. I think it's in any service where there are vulnerable people. I think it happens in children's services. It happens in services for older people.
Yeah, indeed. How did you continue to operate then? in this situation, because you're trying to fight for your son. You're not just somebody off the street. You've worked in the profession. You know what should be done. How did you keep your sanity during this?
Well, it was very difficult. I mean, I've had some really, really low points, including times when I felt suicidal. But I did have a lot of support. So I was trained as a therapist. I had a lot of support from colleagues, from supervisors, from family, from friends. And I also knew the importance of supporting myself. So I also had interest. I did a lot of amateur dramatics. I went horse riding.
You may laugh to yourself about that, but you know, that is self-care. You have to step away from, because otherwise absolutely. You'll be overwhelmed, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. But there came a point when I had to retire.
Right.
So I retired 9 years ago, no, 10 years ago now. It was a point where I needed to be reaccredited, and it was just one pressure too much. It was a particularly difficult time also with my son. And I just felt I couldn't go on. I had a very small practice. I had to keep it manageable. but actually, that also kept me... Sorry, I'm losing my voice.
Quite all right.
That also kept me going, because I really enjoyed my job. And I worked with other parent carers. I worked with parent carers of children with disabilities. So, and that's a very supportive community. So I guess that's where how I kept going. I realise now as I'm talking about it. I mean, I'm probably feeling quite emotional now. I mean,
sure,
my voice has gone really.
It's all right. It's fine. That's fine.
Because it has been a really and still is. Let me say, a really traumatic time.
And so to write this, to go back and relive those moments, you know, it is, you know, hats off to you, Leslie. I mean, it's no easy thing, especially when it is somebody so beloved and so close to you. So what are you hoping that people are going to learn? Should they be questioning? Have things got better? I mean, what are you hoping that people are going to take?
Yeah, there's a new Mental Health Act. So 2025 Mental Health Act. It's still in the process of being. The government think it's going to take 10 years. I mean, I'm still not convinced that it's going to make a massive difference. But some of the issues that I've raised in the book are actually addressed in the Mental Health Act. So I am hoping that the people writing the new practice guidelines and doing the training, I'd like to read my book. So I've already. I've sent a copy to my MP, and I am going to talk to her about taking it to Westminster, because I think it's at that level that things need to change. I've also been in contact with someone who trains Section 12 doctors and AMPs, and he's going to put my book on the reading list, because those are the people that I want to read the book. I want people to reflect on the practice. But I guess the more people that know about it, that, you know, because the other thing is that there's a cultural belief that medication is the answer. I mean, you see it in newspaper articles. You know, somebody has committed a murder because he's gone off his medication. And, you know, most of the time it's nonsense.
Well, you only have to look at the current opiate crisis in the States, which comes from the whole Valley of Dolls thing in the 60s, you know, take pill and chill sort of thing. And it's got out of control. And as we said, you know, earlier in the interview, it's all very well whacking somebody on heavy medication, but they have to come off it at some point. And if it's not managed properly, that can have huge implications, and for not only the person themselves, but, you know, their immediate family and everybody else in the community around them.
And everybody in terms of the cost of it, because the medication causes physical problems. So my son has very high blood pressure. He's very overweight. I mean, I think I'm nearly 80. I think I've probably got, I'm healthier than he is. You know, he's at risk of heart attack, stroke, God knows what.
Yeah.
That's another cost to the NHS, cost to the taxpayer. He's in 24-hour care. That's another cost to the taxpayer. All this has been caused by the treatment. It's very short-sighted. I mean, I feel passionate about the changes that need to happen.
Well, I'm glad that I'm very honoured that you came on to show today to talk about this. The book, listeners, is called Groundhog Day. A mother struggled to protect her son from repeated fails from mental health service. If you go onto our virtual bookstore, listeners, you'll see the front cover. Click on it, and it will be coming its way to you. Leslie, is there any way people can contact you via Troubadour, or do you have any sort of web page yourself, or how can people get into?
No, I haven't because my son is very private.
Sure,
I really wanted to protect his privacy, but I could be contacted via Troubadour.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I know it's not been an easy thing for you today, but congratulations. I think it's something that needed to be written and for greater understanding. The book is called Groundhog Day. It's by Leslie Brown. Leslie, it's been an honour to speak to you today.
Thank you, Giles. Thank you. Thank you for your support.